Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The vegetation is very receptive to burning, and it's also resistant to control.
Residents evacuate as a tundra fire continues to spread near St. Mary's. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, tenants in Anchorage face rising rent costs.
Hey, I just got a raise. We can't celebrate because that's now officially going to rent.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The special primary election for U.S. Representative is June 11th by mail, and an application is not needed. Ballots will start to be sent April 27th. Voters receive the same ballot regardless of political affiliation, and all candidates are on the ballot. The top 4 vote-getters move on to the special general election. Ballots must be mailed, signed, and postmarked by June 11th. More at elections.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Governor Mike Dunleavy has issued a disaster declaration in response to the tundra fire threatening multiple communities along the lower Yukon River. The fire spread closer to the communities of St. Mary's and Pitka's Point overnight. As of this morning, the fire was burning 7.5 miles from the communities. Evacuations continue, and federal officials are deploying more resources to the area to try to prevent the fire from reaching the villages. Meanwhile, another fire has ignited nearby, and the community water tank is leaking. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Tribes in St. Mary's and the nearby village of Pitka's Point are working with the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation to provide a way out for people who need to leave due to age or health conditions. The groups are working with the regional airline Ute Commuter Service to fly people to Bethel. YKHC says they are supporting tribes to voluntarily relocate people, not evacuate them. Ute flew about 80 people to Bethel on Thursday. More people had the option to leave today. In Bethel, people are being housed at the National Guard Armory, and YKHC is talking with the Lower Kuskokwim School District to open another site. Federal officials continue to work to contain the fire. Air tankers are dropping fire retardant around St. Mary's. Beth Ipson is a spokesperson for the Bureau of Land Management, the fire agency working to contain the blaze. She is in St. Mary's now and says the retardant will wet the vegetation and help prevent the fire from moving past it to the communities. The BLM also deployed about a dozen more firefighters to the area since yesterday, increasing the crew to 66. Even more firefighters are scheduled to arrive today. Andrew Flagg is a director with Ute Commuter Service. He says the airline is sending 6 planes to fly firefighters from McGrath to St. Mary's. The fire has spread for a week and a half, and BLM satellite data estimates it's grown to 71,000 acres. Ipson with BLM says constant wind, hot weather, dry grass, and little rain has thwarted fire crews' attempts to contain it so far.
This is a wind and what we call fuel-driven fire, meaning that the wind is pushing it through and the vegetation is very receptive to burning, and it's also resistant to control.
Some firefighters are traveling along the river by boat, working to protect native allotments and fish camps. Meanwhile, overnight, lightning started another fire nearby. This one is burning 33 miles north of Mountain Village and has grown to at least 60 acres. 4 smoke jumpers have been deployed to the fire, and helicopters are dropping water on the area. Ipson says surrounding wetlands could help contain its spread. To complicate efforts, water levels are dropping in St. Mary's drinking water tank. St. Mary's school superintendent Dee Dee Ivanoff says water in the tank has been dropping for days. Last night, it fell 12 inches, and workers have been unable to locate the leak. Ivanov is working with the St. Mary's Corporation to raise money through a GoFundMe campaign to buy pallets of bottled water.
So in case we do have to use up all our water, we will at least have potable water.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is also sending bottled water to St. Mary's. Ute Commuter Service says it will fly the water for free. Jeremy Zedek is the spokesperson for the State Emergency Operations Center. He says the state does not anticipate St. Mary's will experience a drinking water shortage. Meanwhile, on the ground in St. Mary's, Superintendent Ivanov is coordinating rides to the airport for people who want to leave. Her parents flew to Bethel on Thursday.
Just a relief to get people out, especially those that are elderly and at high risk.
She drove people in her truck while her employees drove others in the school bus and van. She called the scene surreal. She says so much smoke blew into the community recently that it set off a school smoke alarm. She is hosting the fire crew in the St. Mary's School and leasing them their vehicles. Community members are also donating their vehicles to the cause. Her sister is loading a boat in case her family needs to leave. But as for Superintendent Ivanov, she intends to stay to oversee the school. Prime fire conditions exist across most of the region. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning for the lower Kuskokwim River Delta. The warning means that the area is experiencing or could soon experience critical fire weather. The area is facing hot, dry conditions and has seen large amounts of lightning. The warning is in effect until 10 p.m. tonight. With reporting help from KYUK's Olivia Eberts, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
In addition to high fuel and grocery prices, Anchorage residents have had to contend with a steep increase for another basic living expense in recent months, and that's rent. City officials are trying to counter the costs by fostering new development in the city, but experts say the trend is likely to continue for at least the next few years. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
One bed, one bath, $1,525. Let's see if it has the square footage.
Ann Doherty is scrolling through Craigslist looking for a new apartment in Anchorage.
It does not have the square footage, but a lot of these, I feel like, a lot of times they're like 600 square feet.
She's a massage therapist who currently lives in Eagle River, but she wants to move closer to her work in Anchorage to cut down on car time and counter rising gas prices. Right now, including utilities, Doherty and her roommate pay about $1,200 to rent an entire house in Eagle River.
But that's like a 2,000, over 2,000 square foot home versus like a little box.
She says she's looking for a modern one-bedroom apartment that won't cost her more than $1,400. But she's having a tough time finding an affordable rental. Cassandra Taggart says Doherty is not alone. Taggart tracks rental trends in the area. She's a real estate broker with Real Property Management Last Frontier. She says rental prices declined in 2019. They stayed flat in 2020.
Then in 21 and 22, it started going up. And in the last 6 months, it has been going up between 20, 30, 40%, depending on the type of rental it is.
Taggart says that tracks pretty closely to the national trend in rising rents. She attributes the Anchorage price hike to a shortage of available rentals and lists several reasons for this. The first is that the COVID-19 pandemic caused a lot of people to stay in their homes instead of moving to a new place.
So they held up real estate that normally they would be moving, whether they'd be adding more units, downsizing, moving out of the state, making transitions, which gives opportunities for other people to move into Anchorage or to shop to upgrade or downgrade.
Taggart says that impacted more than a third of available rentals. She says another thing driving the rental shortage is a higher number of people looking to buy property rather than rent, which in turn takes more rentals off the market. During the pandemic, construction of new housing slowed significantly, adding another layer to the problem. Taggart says vacancy rates in Anchorage are now close to zero, and any solutions will take a while.
Find a way to build more housing or find a way to squeeze and condense more housing in spaces, because that would be a big hit, but we're talking 3-4 years before any of that can happen.
Anchorage real estate director Adam Trombley says the city is doing two main things to boost available housing. The first is working to reduce building fees and allowing more tax breaks for things like mother-in-law apartments. He says earlier this year, the assembly and mayor approved changes to city code that will help.
Where can we change Title 21, which is our zoning laws, and what can we do Title 23, which is our building code, What can we do there to make it easier for the developers, for the builders, for the average person who just wants to go out and maybe remodel a bathroom or build an accessory dwelling unit? What can we do to make it easier for them?
Trombley says another goal is taking public lands and putting them into private hands. He hopes that can foster new private housing developments in the future. In the meantime, Doherty, the massage therapist, says since she's self-employed, she can afford to pay a little more in rent. She might have to temporarily raise her prices, though.
So I can kind of adjust for that with my income because I have a bit more control over it. But someone that's, you know, making $15 an hour, they don't have the ability to change that.
It's a little tougher to adjust for hourly workers like Rin Vinkowski, who works at Best Buy. She and her partner moved into a studio apartment about a year ago, advertised for $800 a month, hoping they'd be able to save up for a house.
They were like, well, everything but your electricity and your internet is included. Only when they say included, it means you're paying that on top of your rent to us. So rent became actually about $900. And then we've both been out due to COVID. And then it was just, well, it's been a year and we've saved nothing.
Vinkowski says her landlord initially said her rent was going to jump to roughly $1,200, but she was able to get it down to about $870, which is a 9% increase. Vinkowski says she recently got a raise of about $1 an hour and moved to full time.
But it also kind of sucks because, hey, I just got a raise. We can't celebrate because that's now officially going to rent.
While she still won't be able to save much, Vinkowski's hopeful that her new raise will at least allow her to stay afloat as rents continue to rise. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the regional director for the Federal Health Department says things here are just different.
I think that's a common theme. Everything about Alaska is unique.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
The regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has been in Alaska this week, touring healthcare facilities and meeting with state, local, and tribal health officials. It's Ingrid Ulrey's first visit to the state, and she says she's been hearing a lot about Alaska's unique health-related challenges, which she hopes the Federal Health Department and funding through some of its grant programs can help with. Ulrey says those challenges include a mental health crisis, disparities in health outcomes during the COVID-19 pandemic, and a severe healthcare worker shortage.
The caring professions in healthcare, in childcare, and particularly within behavioral health are really challenged now to recruit and attract the workforce we need to take care of the population. It's about getting people in through a pipeline, and it's about keeping them and ensuring they don't get burnt out. The over-reliance on traveling nurses is fiscally not sustainable. So how do we get more nurses into the system? I did talk with ANTHC and their partnership with Alaska Pacific University to ease those pipelines and make it as easy as possible to have that partnership between academia and a hospital setting and get more nurses trained. And it's not just nurses. You know, it's the people at the front desk. It's the techs, the medical assistants. Huge shortage there. And looking at how do you encourage people to come in, work in healthcare, and if you're at the lower level positions, provide wraparound support to get the education, certification, training you need to move up a career ladder. So there's a lot of innovation happening in Alaska. But it is a big challenge going forward and one that HHS is putting a lot of energy and focus in, particularly through HRSA, our Health Resources Service Administration, through which a lot of funds flow here to Alaska to support community health.
With some of the groups that you've been talking with, how would they characterize, I guess, what we're calling a mental health crisis? And I guess, how would you characterize that as well?
There are a lot of elements to this. I'd say one thing, you know, bottom line, we need to keep people alive. Everyone here knows that Alaska has historically had one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. Losing people to suicide is devastating for families, for community. I've been talking with a lot of folks here about that. And Alaska is moving towards a crisis now model where we're beefing up our ability to ensure that people have a place to call. So the suicide hotline, a very simple three-digit 988 number to call for people who are in a suicide or other mental health crisis. Some portion of those need not only a place to call, but a mobile team to come out and attend to them. Not necessarily just law enforcement, but people trained in behavioral health. That is starting to be developed around the state of Alaska, as well as a place to go for stabilization in a crisis. And then long haul, some people need a longer term residential bed. And that's, I know, and I'm well aware and have spoken with people about the limitation of beds and the challenge of having people boarding in the emergency department of hospitals who really need, they don't need hospital level of care. They need mental health supports. So I think there's a lot of innovation and positive work happening in Alaska in moving towards a model where we can support people and save lives that are now being lost to suicide.
Your region, you know, encompasses a few states, including Alaska, of course, but also like 270 plus tribes, right? So you must work very closely with the tribal health organizations, I imagine.
Absolutely. So our government-to-government relationships with the tribes is a major and important part of my work as Region 10 director. So as you said, this region covers Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska, and in addition, 272 federally recognized tribes. I really deeply appreciate the leadership in tribal health here in Alaska. We work closely with the Alaska Native Health Board, ANTHC, and Alaska Medical Center, South Central Foundation. I had a chance just this week to visit ANTHC and their leader, Val Davidson, who's doing such innovative work, as well as to get out of Anchorage and visit the Seldovia Village Tribe Health and Wellness Center and seeing how what healthcare looks like in rural Alaska. I really look forward to coming back and spending more time getting out to rural areas of the state to see how this unique tribal health system is working and how HHS, as the government partner to the tribes, can work with them to strengthen access to care.
Are there things about that are unique that you notice compared to maybe other places that you visit that just it looks different or works differently here?
I think that's a common theme. Everything about Alaska is unique and different than how things work in the lower 48. So I think understanding the complexity of the tribal health system, the regional corporations, certain issues like, for example, telehealth, there's nowhere in the country that that's more important than Alaska. And it's unusual to have a Medicaid program that pays for travel, which is essential because beyond basic primary care, off-the-road system, we understand that people need to travel for specialty care or hospital care, so that the travel is expensive, though. And I understand the Medicaid program, the funding for it, is often not sufficient. So to bridge those coverage gaps, to build up the broadband network necessary in the state to support telehealth, not only virtual visits, but just audio only at this time is really important. So I couldn't underscore like how vivid it is to see the value of telehealth and how what we've learned that we can provide healthcare virtually in an effective way, especially for behavioral health. That is very unique to Alaska, how important that's going to be.
That was Ingrid Ulrey, director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Region 10, which covers Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and 272 federally recognized tribes. Ulrey is wrapping up her trip to Alaska this week at the Alaska Black Caucus's health fair in Anchorage tomorrow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska's unique approach to mental health funding is improving the lives of Alaskans who experience behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has a responsibility to generate revenue from its 1 million acres of land and the resources they contain. The trust uses this revenue to help fund statewide programs and initiatives that positively impact trust beneficiaries. To learn more, visit alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Ketchikan's Borough Assembly on Monday overrode a mayoral veto and restored a roughly $1,600 grant to a local LGBTQ organization. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, the controversial funding request for the Ketchikan Pride Alliance was the subject of intense public debate during a heated assembly meeting.
Residents packed the Ketchikan Assembly Chambers to discuss the controversial grant. The Ketchikan Pride Alliance applied for roughly $3,200 in funding for outreach events, including its annual Pride Picnic. The Borough's Grants Committee recommended funding half of the request, but Mayor Rodney Dial rejected it. The money is part of a roughly $390,000 package of grants to nearly two dozen local nonprofits included in the Borough's budget for the next fiscal year. The Assembly unanimously approved the deal last month. Public comment on the issue was split evenly, with 9 speaking in favor and 9 against. Elizabeth Schultz was among those who asked the Assembly to restore funding to the group.
It's estimated that over 1.8 million LGBTQ youth seriously consider suicide every year, and that one attempts suicide every 45 seconds. The data also shows that having at least one accepting adult reduces the risk of suicide by 40% in LGBTQ youth. And communities like ours that can be LGBT-friendly have drastically lower suicide rates.
Others, including Laura Antonsen, said they didn't think the organization should receive any public funding.
By applying for taxpayer dollars, this group is basically insisting that the government sanctions, promotes, and participates in their purpose.
Pride Alliance board member Ryan McHale said he believed the mayor had subjected the LGBTQ group's request to greater scrutiny than other nonprofits.
It appears that Mayor Dial is acting on a personal agenda and his own bias rather than making a decision on the merits of the application and seeing if it meets the needs and desires of the community.
Dial delivered a lengthy presentation explaining why he'd vetoed the roughly $1,600 grant. Among other things, Dial took issue with what he saw as political activism by the group's members. He said funding the group would lead other political organizations to ask for borough money.
And you should know if you approve this funding tonight, you'll be opening the door to this and turning the grant process into a partisan circus.
The Pride Alliance denies the mayor's claims. It says its status as a 501c3 nonprofit organization prohibits political activity. Dial also decried the group's recent initiative distributing window decals to businesses that identify them as allies of the LGBTQ community. He said the sticker campaign amounted to a call for a boycott of businesses that didn't display the decal. He also took issue with some of the content in the Pride Alliance's Loud and Queer zine. Assemblymember Judith McQuarrie, who co-sponsored the veto override, interrupted Dial's presentation midway through to register her dissatisfaction.
The presentation that you're presenting is unfair, uncalled for, and full of inaccuracies, and I object.
The other co-sponsor of the veto override, Assemblymember Jamie Palmer, said she was open to reworking the borough's grant process, but she believed the Pride Alliance was a worthy cause for the borough to support.
If we have children who happen to see a document that is at the public library, a poster on the wall or something, it's like, huh, you know, wow, that actually speaks to me, then that's powerful. And if it allows them to say, oh, okay, maybe I'm not a weird kid, or maybe I'm not completely off, then we're doing our jobs in enhancing the quality of life in this borough. And that's the whole purpose of what we're doing here.
Assemblymember Jeremy Bynum was the lone vote against the override. He said he wasn't sure the Ketchikan Pride Alliance's work aligned with the borough's governmental powers.
Going through this process, it makes me ask a lot of questions about what the intended purpose of our grants committee actually is.
The final vote was 6-1 to restore the Ketchikan Pride Alliance's borough funding. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
This week, two Tlingit dance groups from Wrangell are the co-leads at Celebration, the once every 2 years festival honoring the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people of Southeast Alaska. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, Wrangell dancers are excited to share stories of the community through song and dance.
My sister Jana, Woodsy Nady, this is a wolf that she just put on her blanket. She took the blanket home.
Past the green and red painted totem laid on its side for restoration, folding tables in the back room of Wrangell's Tribal Cultural Center are covered in beads, fur, felt, and paperwork. It's a few days before the start of Celebration 2022.
The regalia is too short for some of the kids, and some of our buttons have fallen off, and we're just repairing, steaming, cleaning.
Juan Tlain, Virginia Oliver, or The Frost on the Beach When the Glacier Passes Over, is Wrangell's Johnson O'Malley, or JOM, coordinator. She's spearheading the logistical effort of getting Wrangell kids to Juneau for Celebration. Wrangell's dancers haven't all been together at Celebration since 2018. The biennial event went virtual in 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The local JOM group, together with the backing group of elders called the Wolf Troop, make up one of the Wrangell dance troops leading Celebration festivities this week in Juneau. The other is the Shchat Kwan, or people near the mainland.
We know that the older dance group is gonna hold it in place for us, and we'll come and do what we do with the children. And they'll stand behind us as the backbone of Wrangell. We'll all be there, so it'll all fall into place.
Some of the Cossetlan JOM dancers, 17 of them according to Oliver, aren't able to attend this year's celebration because of COVID vaccination requirements, which left the mostly student group a bit thin. The school's Indian education program stepped up to bring a small cohort to help fill out the group. One of those students is Mia Wiederspoon.
So I said, my name is Yesh Dlok, so that means Raven's sister.
Wiederspoon says she's most excited to speak Tlingit during Wrangell's performances.
I know I said I was scared, but it's really just anticipation. I think it'll be a huge learning experience for me and an eye-opener on what I can do within the culture.
Leading Celebration has been a long time coming for the Wrangell dancers, who were supposed to lead at the 2020 Celebration that was moved online. Oliver says almost every event at Celebration is a highlight. Seeing people going to markets to get seal grease, dry fish, salves, or supplies for regalia, but that language circles are one of the most important parts for her.
Listening to the language, going to language circles, and seeing your teachers there and finding out what the new programs are.
Members of Wrangell's Native community recently participated in a paddle-making workshop led by Master Carver Doug Chilton of Juneau. In addition to making personal paddles, tribal citizens made 10 paddles for the 10 Wrangell clans, which they'll display during the grand processional and throughout the weekend.
We've never been the lead dance group, but we've all been to Celebration, and it's just such an honor.
As the lead dancers, Celebration's grand entrance and grand exit will begin and end with the Wrangell Coming In Song. Here are Wrangell's Cossetlan dancers and Wolf Troop performing the Coming In Song for the community's first cruise ship visitors earlier this year. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, and Sage Smiley in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Parents, did you know that 1 out of 4 Alaska high school students currently use e-cigarettes? E-cigarettes are easy to use and easy to hide. What teens breathe in and out from e-cigarettes is not safe. It contains cancer-causing chemicals, toxic metals, and nicotine. Nicotine can lead to addiction. It can harm brain development and hurt memory, learning, and attention span. Parents, talk to your teens about vaping. Visit LiveVapeFree at AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quitline.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.